welcome to the fourth episode of the Historic Present podcast, hosted by myself, Charlie Gordon, and my good friend, Jonah Howe. Jonah.
Hello.
Hello.
Today's history section makes this episode perhaps the most special of all episodes so far. We are absolutely delighted to welcome onto the Historic Present podcast author, journalist, and historian, Mr. Guy Walters. Guy, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I am very good, thank you. Thank you very much for joining us. So, in today's episode, we are going to take a look at the Nazi Party, its origins, its rise, and its eventual accession to power. So, Charlie, let's start off.
Yes.
What were the original ideologies and the foundations of the Nazi Party?
So, firstly, we have National Socialism. So, the Nazi Party stood for the National Socialist Workers' Party. And this stood for loyalty for Germany, racial purity, equality, and state control of the economy. Also, we have a lot of racism. So the Aryans, the white Europeans, were considered to be the master race, and all other races, including Jews, gypsies, and other physically, mentally handicapped people, were seen to be inferior. Hitler believed that war and struggle were an essential part of developing a healthy Aryan race as well. He was also very intent of gaining living space and Lebensraum, as Germany needed to expand as its people were hemmed in. This expansion would be mainly at the expense of Russia and Poland. And yeah, that's the main ideologies of the party.
Okay, so the Nazi Party, or the National Socialist Party, although they were very far from socialism, were this right-wing extremist group in Germany rising from about the early 1920s to the early 1930s before they took full control over Germany.
I'm going to interrupt you there because I think you've got to look at the roots of Nazism as they're just one of many far-right, crazy, out-there parties developing around the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. So the roots are a little bit earlier than you suggest. I think that you've got to remember that, you know, in the mess after the First World War, you know, you had a lot of these far-right parties, you know, popping up in Germany and Austria, Switzerland, France, Britain. So let's not think of the Nazi Party being a kind of, you know, it's got the exclusive right to the kind of far-right brand, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
It's important to bear in mind that, you know, it was, until Hitler got his mitts on it, a pretty small, obscure party, you know, in and around Munich. And, you know, Hitler could have joined any one of these far-right parties and turned it into what, you know, became what we think of as the Nazi Party. The other thing to think about is also the fact that, as you absolutely correctly say, that race is really important. And it's this idea of race being a battle line. You know, today we have the kind of the culture wars about, you know, how left and right you are, how progressive you are, what you think about, you know, certain issues like trans or whatever it is. Back then, it was very much, the battlefront was about race. And it was about also Jewishness and its perception that, you know, Jews were the root of all the kind of societal troubles that Germany was feeling. And again, I have to stress that, you know, the Nazi Party did not have the monopoly on anti-Semitism. You know, it was something that it was out there. It sadly remains out there. And, you know, at sort of different levels, you may have heard the expression drawing room anti-Semitism, a kind of polite, inverted commas, anti-Semitism that people might express, you know, at a dinner party in Hampstead in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. But, you know, of course, what you see with the Nazi Party is it goes out of the drawing room and onto the streets and becomes, you know, literally murderous. So I think it's very important. I think you're absolutely correct to nail that. And I think this idea of expansionism, Lebensraum, as you absolutely correctly identify, living space, you've got to remember, think of where Germany is in Europe. You know, it is, as you say, hemmed in. Also, Hitler, Nazi Party, they look at countries like Britain, France, and they go, these countries have got empires. Why don't we have an empire? So Germany desperately wants an empire as well, and that is part of it. So I think you're absolutely right, but I think it's important to trace the roots of the Nazi Party back a little bit further.
Yeah, definitely. And myself and Jonah, as Jews ourselves, we both understand that the legacy of Hitler has definitely had a darkened imprint on society. Yeah. And I just would like to read out a quote from a historian named Ian Kershaw. He said it in 1998, so 10 years after the Cold War finally ended. And it says, "The 12 years of Hitler's rule permanently changed Germany, Europe, and the world. He is one of the few individuals of whom it can be said with absolute certainty, without him, the course of history would have been different. Hitler's immediate legacy, the Cold War, a Germany split by a wall, a Europe split by an iron curtain, a world split between hostile superpowers armed with weapons able to blow up the planet, ended only a decade ago. The deeper legacy, the moral trauma bequeathed to posterity, has still not passed." I think personally, this is a very powerful.
I think that's a very good quote. And Ian Kershaw was a brilliant historian, as you know. I think there's a thing in history which you may have studied. I don't know. It's called the great man theory of history, and it's an accusation about old fashioned teaching methods in which you teach, you know, people about great men or, you know, great women, and how great men, you know. And, you know, it's an old-fashioned type of teaching history in which you say that great men are responsible for, you know, things happening. And without great men, nothing happens and nothing gets done. The other way of looking at it is, are people like Hitler kind of, you know, would these things have happened anyway? Would there have been a Second World War? You know, were there political undercurrents like racism, like German expansionism? Would these things have all happened anyway? And if it wasn't Hitler, it might have been someone called Bob. Or whatever it was. Yeah, it didn't really matter who it was.
Yeah.
I think you can very, very confidently say, to agree with Kershaw, and it's a very good quote, that I think Hitler was, you know, clearly not a great man, but in terms of the argument, in terms of an individual affecting the lives of all of us, then there's no doubt that he qualifies for that. I think you're absolutely right.
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay, so now we're going to move on to the first grab at power the Nazi Party took. So we're going to set our minds to 1923 and look at the Munich Putsch, or also known as the Beer Hall Putsch. So by 1923, the Nazis were still very much a minority party, one that's not taken too seriously. But Hitler was beginning to give them an increasing profile. So, in November 1923, Hitler believed that the moment had come for him to topple the Weimar government, which we, of course, have covered in previous episodes. The government was preoccupied with the economic crisis, with the French occupation of the Ruhr and hyperinflation growing. So, on the 8th of November, Hitler hijacked a local government meeting and announced he was taking over the government of Bavaria. He was joined by the old war hero, Ludendorff.
Nazi stormtroopers began taking over the official buildings, and the next day, however, the Weimar government forces hit back, and the police rounded up the stormtroopers, and in a brief exchange of shots, 16 Nazis were killed by the police. And what's incredible about it is, I believe, a bullet missed Hitler by an inch and hit Hermann Göring in the leg, one of the major members of Hitler's inner circle and a huge figure in the Third Reich. And the rebellion broke up in chaos, and Hitler escaped in a car while Ludendorff and the others stayed to face the armed police. Hitler had gambled and miscalculated, and the revolution effectively failed. But obviously, as we know, this was not the end of the story.
No, it's not. But at the time, of course, when it was reported, and you only have to look at old copies of the Times, it was felt, well, that's the end of this silly little man, Hitler.
Yeah.
You know, and people were, you know, writing him off and saying, I remember reading an article in the Times, you know, after the putsch, or when Hitler, you know, was eventually, I know we're going to discuss his imprisonment,
yeah,
and saying, well, you know, that's the end of him, and hopefully he'll slip back into obscurity that he deserves. I mean, the Beer Hall Putsch is almost a kind of comic episode in some ways. It's such a screw-up. Frankly, it's such a cock up. And the idea that you would be able to sort of take over, you know, this, you know, part of Germany and seize power for the whole of the whole of, you know, German state just by marching through a street in Munich, it seems ridiculous. Now, and you're absolutely right to crystallise the fact that it was, you know, a real cock up, and you know, it was badly led by Hitler. It was very confused, and in many ways, it did, as well as, you know, seeing Hitler obviously, you know, sent to court. It did enormous reputational damage to the Nazi Party, because you think, well, you know, if you can't organise, you know, if you can't get this right, there's really no hope for you lot. You know, this is farcical. It's pathetic. And just another interesting sort of coda to it is that you mentioned Hermann Göring being wounded, and it's as a result of that. You've got to remember Hermann Göring, for those who don't know that much about him. Hermann Göring was a war hero.
Yeah.
He was really, from the First World War, he had gained the medal called the Blue Max, which is called the Pour la Mérite medal, which is actually not a French medal, it's a German medal.
He always wore it.
And he was an ace pilot. And so he was a national hero, Hermann Göring. So to have him on your kind of side was a real coup for the Nazis. But he gets wounded, and as a result of being treated for his gunshot wound, he is given morphine, which basically, as you know, is an opiate, and he rather likes morphine,
yeah.
And he rather likes having too much morphine.
Yeah.
And it's from that point that actually Göring's drug addiction, I mean, he's a junkie effectively for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
He's basically a heroin addict, and that's as a result of that wound and his heroin usage and depression. You know, he becomes this absurd figure in many ways who Hitler absolutely, by the end of the war, you know, as no doubt you'll see in later episodes, you know, he becomes this elephantine absurd figure. But you can trace the roots of Göring's ridiculousness to that moment when he's shot in Munich in 23.
Exactly. So in the short term, no doubt the Munich putsch was a complete disaster from Hitler, which we've summarised. He had completely miscalculated the mood of the German people, and the Nazis had been utterly humiliated. People did not rise up to support him. I guess he could have looked back a few years at the Spartacist Revolution of 1919 and the cat putsch of 1920.
1920?
Yeah, 1922.
Yeah,
of 1922. Other failed uprisings, but he thought he could do better, but it goes down along the same lines of the other uprisings. Well, exactly. And he gets put on trial and he's sentenced to 5 years in prison. But one fact is that Hitler impressed the judges so much that he and his accomplices got off quite lightly. And he actually only ended up serving 9 months in prison, I believe. 9 months? And and he was given, I think it was... He was suspended from the party until 1927, 26.
He wasn't allowed to speak publicly until 1927.
That was right, yeah. And in prison, he wrote Mein Kampf, which...
We'll get on to that later.
Which outlined his views.
So I want to go back to the court day and his judgment. The judging of Hitler at the end of the Munich putsch was very famous and was put on newspaper headlines around Europe. And so Hitler did get some recognition, I suppose, from this, although it was recognition from his failure in court instead of a successful uprising. So yeah, the judge was anti-communist, wasn't he? And
yes.
He was slightly right-wing,
yeah.
You know, slightly, yeah. I suppose. So like you said, Hitler did get off rather lightly in terms of his actual sentence. He was allowed lots of free time outside of his cell. I even think he was throwing a birthday party in prison where he was allowed to invite friends, and I think there was cake. So in comparison to what should have been given, such as maybe Mondeleuve after the Reichstag fire, because this is, of course, he was sentenced for treason. He gets off rather lightly.
No, you're right. I mean, he could easily have been executed for doing it. It was sedition, pure and simple. And he was very lucky. Yes, you're right. He did impress the judge. And actually, I think the problem you have is with all these things is that you end up, you know, when you put someone like that on trial, in prison, you make them into a martyr. And even if you are technically stopping them from participating in political activity, it's very easy to present yourself as this sort of martyr-like figure. I mean, martyrdom is, and is, Hitler, as you've got to remember, is a narcissist. He's absolutely obsessed with himself more than anyone else, and the world is there for him. And narcissists love, you know, any form of attention, as you know. So if that attention is in a court, it puts them in a prison, it's a real opportunity for them. The best thing you can do with a narcissist is to ignore them. Yeah. And as Eaton is finding out to its cost with this man, Mr. Nolan, who is, you've probably seen the story.
Yeah.
And that teacher is a classic narcissist. He wants the attention. I'm not saying he's like Hitler, but I'm saying is that the way to deal with these people is simply to ignore them. Yes. And I'm putting them in prison, putting them on trial. Yeah, you've got to do it, but also you're giving him an arena. A courtroom is just where Hitler wants to be. He's got an audience and he can whip it up.
That's right. So Hitler's imprisonment time was very important for the reformation of the Nazi Party. Hitler realized that the Nazi Party couldn't just take power by thuggishly storming their way to the Reichstag and taking power. They needed to go via the legal system. As well as this, he and Hess, Rudolf Hess, who later became the Deputy Führer, wrote Mein Kampf, My Struggles, during their time in prison, which outlined Hitler's beliefs, ideologies, and his plans, I guess. So he had to make a decision, and that was to transform the Nazi Party from a party of failed uprisers
to politicians.
To politicians.
Effectively.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, he's going to turn it from a rabble, which is what it is, failed rabble. And he's going to turn it into a political movement that's going to have to seize power legally. He recognises that is part of Hitler's. I mean, you know, it doesn't take a genius to work out that you're not going to storm your way to power after the beer hall putsch. You're going to have to do it, you know, through the electoral system. Obviously we'll see that taking place. I just want to go back to Mein Kampf very quickly. My Struggle. It really is. I mean. Do have a try of reading it if you have, but it is really the most dreadfully muddled, you know, nonsense. And of course, it's horrible, a lot of it. But what you're seeing in Mein Kampf is, again, these ideas in there are just cherry-picked by Hitler from, you know, people left, right, and center. So, you know, he doesn't express one original idea in that book. You know, there is no specific philosophy that is exclusively Hitler's. He just takes, you know, crazy right-wing thought or social Darwinist thought that kind of treats people as different species, different races, different species, different animals, so to speak. And he applies a lot of very twisted logic. And so, you know, it's one of those books, you know, that people sort of end up buying, but they never read. And it's part of the seductive narrative, the narcissist Hitler in prison writing the book, My Struggle, and then outlining his blueprint. So, yeah, it's prison makes Hitler in many ways.
Precisely. And when he got out in 1925, Hitler's first thing he did was he enlarged the SA. About 55% of the SA came from the ranks of the unemployed, and many were ex-servicemen of the war. And he also set up a new group called the SS, chiefed by Heinrich Himmler. And the SS was similar to the SA, but were fanatically loyal to Hitler personally, whereas the SA were more thuggish and the SS were a bit more sort of cultured, should I say. I mean, you know, and the membership of the party eventually rose to 100,000 by 1928. So things were looking good for Hitler. And as well as that, Hitler appointed Joseph Goebbels to take charge of the Nazi propaganda. And Goebbels was highly efficient at spreading the Nazi message. He and Hitler believed that the best way to reach to what they called the masses was by appealing to their feelings rather than by rational argument. So Goebbels produced posters, leaflets, films, radio broadcasts. He organized rallies, and he also set up photo opportunities?
I think. Can I come in?
Yeah, of course, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I just go back to just to explain a little bit more about the SA and the SS. I mean, the SA stands, they're the stormtroopers, yeah, or they're called the brown shirts as well. And it stands for Sturmabteilung. And they were actually a kind of paramilitary force. And yes, you're right, they consisted of a lot of old soldiers. You had a lot of soldiers who felt that after the First World War, Germany had been stabbed in the back by her political leaders. And there's this thing you probably know called the stab in the back myth.
Yes, yeah.
And so a lot of the SA are drawn from what were called the Freikorps movement, which are a kind of paramilitary movement, movements that were, you know, very popular in Germany. And they had names like Steel Helmet and, you know, all these sort of kind of typical sort of German names. And anyway, but the, I think that what the SA was an important part of the whole Nazi movement. You know, it is a kind of like a private army, if you like. But Hitler realized he didn't have it really under his control, and it becomes a problem, you know, when he's in power. So you're going to look at the roots of the SA at this point, and you're right to bring it up. You know, it does, you know, they look impressive. The iconography of it looks impressive. The SS, just to sort of amplify what you mentioned there, it stands for Protection Squad, Schutzstaffel. And, you know, it really was, to begin with, just a kind of very modest organization. But it ends up becoming, as you know, an industrial complex, its own army. It runs the concentration camps. It runs the death camps. You know, it becomes this huge kind of octopus, if you like, that spreads all over Nazi Germany. But it's simply there initially just to protect Hitler. So, yeah, it does have a slightly higher entry criterion than the SA. But again, these paramilitary units are making the Nazi Party look like it's its own state already. And that, of course, is going to probably, you know, transmit quite well politically.
Definitely. And unfortunately for Hitler and the Nazis, as a result of the golden years and the prosperous times of the Stresemann era from 1924 to 29, people really weren't interested in extreme polarized politics because everything was going so well. And there was only a certain amount of people that Hitler really could appeal to. And although they had a great campaign, they only won 3% of the seats in the Reichstag, 12 seats in the 1928 elections. Yeah. Yes. But what happens next?
So like we mentioned last episode, 1929 was neither a good year for Germany, the US, or the rest of the world. The Great Depression, the stock market crash of 1929, probably affected Germany worse of all other nations in Europe. The loans agreed in the Dawes Plan were called back almost immediately, and they were thrown into deep poverty and
mass unemployment
and living conditions severely slumped. As a result of this,
Hitler the narcissist seized his chance. Enter the Nazis. And the Nazis' 25 points were very attractive to the most vulnerable to the Depression, so the unemployed, the elderly, and the middle class. And Hitler also offered them culprits to blame, the communists and the Jews. And none of these messages were really new, and they had not won the support. Nazis hadn't won the support of the people in the Stresemann years. But the difference now was that the Democratic Party simply could not get Germany back to work.
So Charlie just mentioned the 25 points. I'm just going to give you a brief introduction to what some of these main points were. So the most important points of the 25 Nazi point program were the abolition of the Treaty of Versailles, a union or Anschluss of Germany and Austria, only true Germans to be allowed to live in Germany, large industries and businesses to be nationalized, generous old age pension, and a strong central government. So these messages become particularly poignant when the Weimar constitution and politics and politicians don't seem to be doing anything, as they become very indecisive and all legal procedures seem to be taking a long time. So Hitler's ideas now seem to have a special relevance. Is the Weimar government indecisive? Yeah. Then Germany needs a strong leader, a strong central figure to change your lives. Are reparations adding to Germany's problems? Then kick out the Treaty of Versailles. Is unemployment a problem? Yes, let the unemployed join the army, build Germany's armaments, and be used for public works like road buildings.
I think that's a really good distillation, and you've really captured how, you know, crisis was a great opportunity for Hitler. In fact, the Chinese ideogram character for crisis is the same one as opportunity. The Chinese know that, you know, a disaster can be a really helpful thing. Yeah. The Wall Street crash, without the slump, without the depression, there would have been no Hitler. There would have been no Nazi party in power. You're absolutely right. And it Hitler plays it incredibly well. And you know, he take away the racism, take away the kind of hideousness of Nazism. There's nothing wrong with putting the unemployed to work. You know, there's nothing wrong with, you know, doing public works projects. I mean, we see that going on in America at the same time, you know, the New Deal. Yeah. So, you know, there's nothing sort of, a lot of what Hitler's doing isn't necessarily evil. You know, it's actually, you know, he's trying to restore national pride. He's trying to ensure that, you know, you're not taking a wheelbarrow full of cash to go and buy a loaf of bread. So it's, you know, these are all, you know, some of these things are perfectly reasonable. Of course, what isn't reasonable in any way is blaming the nation's ills on a certain group of people.
Yeah,
precisely. And so in the 1930 elections, the Nazis got 107 seats. And in November 1932, they got nearly 200.
So they're on the rise.
Precisely. And one question we have to ask ourselves is, why did the Nazis succeed in the elections? And the simple answer is the Depression. But there were many other factors that allowed the Nazis to seize this opportunity. And firstly, we have the Nazi campaigning. So, you know, Guy, tell us a bit about that.
Well, I mean, obviously, you've mentioned Joseph Goebbels earlier, who was the propaganda chief of the Nazi Party. I think it's the cult of personality that the German electorate find very seductive. And if you think of footage of the time, Hitler is arriving by aeroplane. You know, yeah. This is the first time you've got a kind of political leader in Europe who's sort of coming down from the skies to preach his message and go away. There's a kind of messianic feel to the man.
Yeah, exactly.
That's strong leadership. And of course, he is called the Führer, the leader. Yeah. So, you know, he already says he's in charge, even though he's not. He's only in charge of his party. So I think it's also he feels modern. And I think the Nazi Party is very good at looking modern. And that is partly thanks to Goebbels. It's embracing this idea that fascism is a modern creed. You look in Italy, you know, who looks more modern? Mussolini or the existing power structures? Mussolini looks more modern. Yeah. Who looks more modern in Germany? Hitler and his aeroplanes, his speech-making, his iconography, his 25-point plan. This feels stronger, more confident, much better, you know, to many German people than simply the kind of vacillation and the weakness of Weimar and those kind of old-style politicians. It feels fresh, it feels new, it feels exciting. He feels like a man who's going to get things done. And in a way, he does.
Precisely.
So although the targeted political campaign of the Nazis seemed to be more modern than any other competing parties, Hitler still wasn't the Chancellor of the Reichstag. The Nazi Party was still not in control. So what happens next, Charlie?
Well, we've got further campaigning strategies of the Nazis, and one of these strategies was a disillusionment with democracy. And perhaps the biggest negative was a dissatisfaction with democracy in Weimar Germany, and politicians under weak coalition governments seemed to be unable to tackle the problems of the Great Depression. And when the Depression began to bite, the Chancellor Brüning actually cut government spending welfare benefits, and he urged Germans to make sacrifices. And this was disastrous for the Republic, as it gave Nazis the opportunity to exploit the discontent in Germany.
So what happened next? How did he how did he get into the position of Chancellor?
Well, good question. After the elections in the Reichstag, of July 1932, the Nazis were the largest single party with 230 seats, but they did not have an overall majority. And Hitler demanded the post of Chancellor. However, Hindenburg was suspicious of Hitler and he refused.
This is President Hindenburg.
President Hindenburg, yes. And he allowed Chancellor Franz von Papen to carry on. He then used his emergency powers to pass the measures that von Papen hoped would solve the unemployment problem. Again, another example of Hindenburg abusing Article 48.
Would that be abusing it, though?
Well, that is for fair minds to judge, but it's clear that he's using it quite frequently at the moment. Yes, there's a crisis, but it really does undermine democracy. However, von Papen was soon in trouble, and his party had no support in the Reichstag, and so he called yet another election.
I think just to say briefly, you've got to realise this is the old order really not recognising that the landscape's changed. You know, the rug is being pulled from under their feet, and they're just not realising it. They don't have the solutions. They don't have the kind of political strength. They're old-fashioned, and it's, you know, you can never say things are inevitable, but it really does feel, and Hitler can feel it in his bones, that this is just going to come right for him at some point. You know, it does feel inevitable.
Exactly. And we have the November 1932 elections. The Nazis also came out as the largest party, and although their vote share fell. And then, in January 1933, Hindenburg appointed Hitler as Chancellor. And through January 1933, Hindenburg and von Papen met secretly with industrialists, army leaders, and politicians. And on 30th of January, to everyone's surprise, they offered Hitler the post of Chancellor. With only three Nazis in the cabinet and von Papen as vice chancellor, they were confident that they could effectively control Hitler's influence and resist his extremist demands. And the idea was that his policies would be made by the cabinet, which were filled with conservatives like von Papen. Hitler would be able to get support in the Reichstag for those policies and control the communists. That was the idea. But with hindsight, we can understand that this was not a good idea, and effectively Hindenburg's plan was foiled.
They thought they could control Hitler, that he'd be a relatively quiet, easy to control chancellor for a few years as this crisis of the Great Depression goes, and then we can restart with a proper serious chancellor. How great this underestimation
It was a bit of an error, wasn't it? Yes. It was a bit of an error.
Yeah.
They still saw him as the little corporal.
Well,
you know, which is his rank in the First World War. And they just regarded him as someone who could be manipulated, and they just didn't realise that actually they were the ones being manipulated all the way through. And this is part of Hitler's political genius, is that, you know, he's making people feel that he's the one being wagged, whereas he is wagging them. You know, and it's going to be just a matter of time that, you know, he's going to solidify his grip. I just want to make one final point. Everyone thinks when Hitler comes to power, that's it. Nazism has got iron control of Germany from the word go, and suddenly the Gestapo appears and the SS appears and all that.
Yeah.
You know, as you'll see, and as you probably know, the Nazis take a long time to get a grip on power to the extent to which they want, and there are going to be some things required. So, yeah, don't think that when Hitler, you know, kicks off, that's it, he's totally in control. You know, he is very worried about his position. He doesn't feel as strong a chancellor as he wants to.
And a catalyst for such accession to complete power existed in one certain fire of one certain very important building.
Well, we'll talk about this next episode. So we'll talk about the Reichstag fire, the Enabling Act, the Night of Long Knives, and the oath of the German army towards Hitler. But for today, that's a wrap. Guy, thank you so much for joining us. It's been fantastic having you on.
We have really valued your time. Thank you very much.
Not at all. You chaps know, you know more than I do. You're both brilliant. Thank you very much. And if you want me on again, I'd be very happy.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So that concludes this episode's history section, and we will now swiftly move on to the politics section. Thank you so much, Mr. Walters, again, for joining us. So as this is the last episode before Christmas, we're going to add a little Christmas twist onto the political discussion of today.
Festive twist.
So as you are probably aware, the all four countries in the UK have unanimously agreed to impose a relaxation of lockdown measures across the Christmas period. And so, Charlie and I will be discussing whether that was a good or bad decision, whether it was needed, or whether it will impose serious damage to our health and all our lives. So, Charlie, kick us off. Where do you stand on this situation?
Well, I'm very much against the entire Christmas relaxation of the rules, in which households are allowed to mix with, I think it's two other families.
Three.
From the 3rd to the 27th of December.
It's three.
And, pardon?
It's three.
Three households, yeah, in total. And with cases increasing rapidly, it's really quite a dangerous and risky thing for the government to do, for something that people can live without. People can go to Christmas without their families. And also, there's been a lot of talk about other festivals being foregone, so such as Eid, Hanukkah, and it's not all about Christianity in the country, and that's one thing that the government needs to address. It is, in a sense, it can be seen as slightly racist because, or biased because, other religions aren't able to celebrate their festivals this year because of this, but the government have allowed a risky and dangerous window for us to mix, and possibly, and it'll possibly cost loads and loads of lives, thousands of lives, this window.
Okay. I kind of understand where you're coming from. On your first point, Charlie, you said people can spend Christmas alone. The government aren't forcing everyone to go outside and mix with other households. If you don't want to go out, there's no... You still have a choice. If you're at risk, the government is not forcing you to go out across the festive period. It is giving you the option to. So if you thoroughly believe that you don't need to go out and you can do this in your own household or alone, there's no expectation for you to follow the new relaxation guidelines.
Well, but that allows an abuse of the rules, perhaps, for certain families, isn't it?
How?
Some people have a very relaxed view of the virus as it is, and many people in this country, millions of people, who do not understand the full effects of the coronavirus, and the full effects of the coronavirus equal death for many people, and
that's not really. Alongside your point,
giving people the option is still a dangerous thing to do. Giving people the option, people may not understand that they have underlying health conditions. People may think they don't have the virus. 80% of people are asymptomatic. No one knows if they've got it. For all I know, I've got it. Well, you've got it. Do you know what I mean? Like,
if people are worried about going out this Christmas, they don't have to go out. They're not being forced to go out. It's an option. They're just given the option. So if they're worried and they have underlying health conditions, they do not have to go out. The new Christmas rules are not forcing anyone to do anything.
No, but people do still have to go into work. People still have to go into school. With people mixing together on Christmas Day, everyone will be eating lunch together. Or there'll be a mix of families. Some some guy may work in a hen.
If you don't want to go out because you are scared for your own health, because you believe you are at risk, you do not have to go out. I've said this three times.
But even giving people the option is dangerous. That's what I'm saying. It's still a dangerous thing to do, to give people the option to do so. People underestimate you.
Okay, so it is without a doubt this country needs a break from all of this. Yeah? So many businesses are on the line of complete collapse. The Christmas break of lockdown will be so unbelievably beneficial for all our mental health and economic benefits.
How? Economic? It's 5 days.
5 days over the Christmas period. You don't understand how important that is. Restaurants, going away for a hotel, going away to a hotel for a few days over Christmas. Shops for late Christmas shopping. Millions, but potentially billions of pounds.
I'm looking at the long term here. This is just short term.
But it will help the long term, because without this, so many businesses will go under.
This, cases will double overnight. And therefore, we're going to be in a lockdown, and in these tiers, tier three, tier two, for such an extended period of time compared to what we would have.
But that is the risk we're going to have to take. Because without this, the economy already suffering so badly would just completely crumble.
Look, I understand, but I personally, with the Christmas thing, I think it should be more strict. I think it's probably a good thing, but I think you should be able to make a small support bubble, for example. So maybe a couple of people outside your household. So like grandparents, maybe. Pardon?
You can. That's what.
No, but you're being allowed to have three different households. So if you've got three different families of five, right, that's 15 people in one room, indoors most likely, because in Christmas time, you're not gonna be outdoors. It's too cold, isn't it?
It does raise the issue of what if you have a very large family. I do understand that. Like, what if you got lots of cousins and lots of...
Yes, exactly. That's my point.
...extended family. How are you going to get...
It's all subjective.
Around your religion point, I am not Christian, so don't shout at me saying, oh, I don't know what it feels like to be a minority. But we are a Christian country. And we do need this break from lockdown. Whether it was August or April or November, we need this. And it just so happens to be around Christmas time, so we may as well do it over Christmas time.
Okay, well, on the religion point, it is also... religion for me is not that important to me.
You raised it.
I raised it, but it's not like my most important issue. The most important issue for me is looking at the long term and looking to save lives. As I said, as I've reiterated, people underestimate the virus, and therefore people will superficially think that they're okay to go out and have a good time over Christmas when all of a sudden, oh God, I've got the coronavirus. And then they have to self-isolate. What about the grandparents they've been seeing? What happens to them?
Well, they'd also have people, to self-isolate.
Yes, people vulnerable. It means they're likely to die. And we want to limit down the deaths as much as possible and get out of this as quick as possible. So if you cut that window out of Christmas, right, then cases won't go up and we can slowly stabilise with the vaccine being rolled out in the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or whatever, because... it's important that we keep the population healthy. That's the most. That is, in my opinion, the most important thing.
Listen, I understand where you're coming from. I agree that with the start of the rolling out of the vaccine and the plateauing of the cases.
Why is it worth taking the risk if you're going to have a vaccine?
I understand where you're coming from. But the economic benefits, and probably more importantly, the mental benefits, just completely outweigh 4 days worth of risk risk-taking, in my opinion. And like I said, if you are scared of these new rules, if you think you're still at risk, you're not being forced to go out. So stay at home. This is for people who haven't seen a branch of their family since March, who need this.
Well, what I would say to that is that with the government giving the all clear for people to do this, a lot of people rely on the expertise of the government. I say that in inverted commas, but because, you know, if the government body with the top scientists in the country are saying that it's okay for you to do so, why wouldn't you do so? Why wouldn't you trust the government that you're doing the right thing?
Just give you the option. We don't live in a dictatorship.
No, but it's still psychological for people though, because if you're being told something by the highest order, or I can't really describe the highest people in this country, that it's safe to do this, then you do it. I know I would probably.
Yeah, you probably will go out over Christmas.
I probably will.
So why are you so adamant that it's bad for us if you yourself are getting?
No, but I'm saying because the government are saying that it's okay. I'm just trying to make a point. My point is that the government are giving us the all clear to do so. Why wouldn't you do so? Why wouldn't you?
You've made it clear why you wouldn't, because it's so bad for our. It's such
yes,
a risk
but I'm saying that's why they need to stop it. They need to cut that out this window.
So it's Charlie Gordon, will you, having outlined all these risks, will you yourself be going out from the 23rd to the 27th of December and mixing with other households?
No, I won't be going out. But first of all, when I say that, the government are allowing me to do so. So if the government were to completely cut out I'm saying that the government have to completely cut this window out, make it as normal.
I think it'd be broken anyway. Are you saying if the government didn't introduce this and there were still the harshest restrictions over Christmas, yeah, people would break them? I think it's inevitable either way.
I'm not saying people would break them. Are you saying people would break them?
Either way, people will go out, and either way, people will mix with households over
yes,
Christmas.
Yes, but it's called minimizing. It's minimizing the risk. Less people will go out. It's deterrence.
No, so on one hand, with the strictest restrictions, you got shops and restaurants shut, so the economy in distress, and then you got people breaking the rules. With relaxation, you've got economy yay, and people doing the same as they were the strictest restrictions.
Yeah, but what's your immune system going to say about that? It's got COVID in it. 75-year-old man or woman with an underlying
75-year-old man has probably been advised to stay at home.
Possibly, but the point is that it's too much of an opening. The government are making it too easy, in my opinion. They're making it far too easy. It needs to be more controlled. I know it sounds like a dictatorship, but it's not. In this kind of circumstances, I think the government has to take more control. You know, liberty is all very well in a normal society, but in this society, where our lives are being controlled by this virus, it's important that the government have some control over our lives. I know I'd be very...
Okay, we're going to have to wrap up there because we're going over time. But thank you, Charlie, for that. And either way, I wish you a Merry Christmas. And I wish all the listeners a Merry Christmas. I know Leo Hall somewhere sitting there is thoroughly agreeing with me after this debate during form time. Anyway, once again, thank you so much to Mr. Guy Walters for joining us today. We really, really valued your time and we can't thank you enough. That concludes the fourth episode of the Historic Present podcast. We'll be back in January with some more episodes. But for the time being, it's goodbye from me. Goodbye. And goodbye from Charlie.
Goodbye.